on Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. Our interview this month is with British-Irish writer and broadcaster Kit DeWall. Born in Birmingham to an Irish mother and Caribbean father, she initially pursued a career in law, working alongside foster carers and the social care sector, before turning to writing and broadcasting. Her debut novel, My Name is Leon, was shortlisted for the Costa Book Award. Her short fiction has won and been nominated for numerous prizes. Soon after the publication of My Name is Leon, she began working on the Kit DeWall Creative Writing Scholarship, which provides a fully funded place for a disadvantaged writer on the Creative Writing MA course at Birkbeck College in London. The interviewer is Yole Dexter.
Hello, Kit. It's so nice to meet you.
And you?
My first question is about finding your voice. So I've got a blog and I publish a lot of my rawest opinions, and I find that they change from hour to hour sometimes, let alone year on year. And there is always that worry that for someone at the beginning of their writing career, it could be damaging. Like your formative work, setting the tone of people's perception of you and your interests and your writing style. But you, in this way, have kind of done things differently, and you came into success at a later stage writing like properly, in inverted commas, in your 40s. And then you had this phenomenal success with My Name is Leon. Do you think that that's when you had truly found your voice and then you were able to tell these stories, or that's kind of why you wrote it at this time? And following on from that, do you feel that you've gone into the publishing industry and been able to make your own rules?
Right. So first of all, I'm not one of those people that always wanted to write. So I was never looking for my voice. I started writing in my 40s just because I had the time. You know, I could have done flower arranging or I could have done macrame. And I just happened to choose writing. And I'm not being flippant. I really mean I had time. Oh, what shall I do? I'll do this thing. I thought I'd be great at it. I'd read hundreds of books. I loved reading. So I just thought, yeah, I'll write a book. I'll send it to Penguin and they'll publish it, and it'll be about 6 weeks. It'll be in Waterstones on the 3-for-2 table. And I'm not joking. That's what I thought. I'd never heard of an agent. I'd never heard of Hachette. I'd only ever in my writing life ever heard of Penguin. So I didn't know there was other things. I was completely, completely naive. With that naivety, I wrote two thrillers, which definitely do have my voice. I like the thriller genre, but I couldn't get them published because they weren't very good and because there was something, there's a disconnect, I think, between what I was writing and what I intended to write. So, for example, I sent them off to an agent, and this agent said, too much of a thriller to be a literary novel, too literary to be a thriller. He actually said, tell me what shelf this goes on in Waterstones. When I wrote My Name is Leon, I wrote what I wanted to write. I never thought I was writing in my voice. I never thought I was different from anyone else. I wrote it without thinking, and I wrote it thinking it would never get published because my other two had failed. So with that immense freedom, I wrote My Name is Leon. I wrote it like, well, this is what I want to say and this is how I want to say it. I knew what good writing was by then because I didn't know before. I thought it was good. I thought my mum would buy it, my sisters would buy it, my friends would tell me I was great, but that was as far as it would go. Didn't think it would get published. And no one was more surprised than I was when it did get published. If you're a new writer, sometimes you don't even know what people are talking about when they say, oh, you know, use your voice, or you've got a unique voice. And they think, what is that writing style? Is that the genre I'm writing in? Is that the sentence? What is voice? And I would say voice is this. There's lots of books that will tell you, and lots of research that says there are seven stories in the whole world, versions of seven stories. lots of books published about what they are, academic books, and they say, these are the seven stories. In other words, nobody is going to write an original story. It's going to be a version of Love or The Quest or Revenge or Coming of Age or Maturation or The Riddle or whatever. It's going to be a version. The only thing any of us have that is not Charlotte Bronte, Doris Lessing, John le Carré, the only thing we have is that we are us. We are us. And when we talk to our friends and when we talk to our family and when we think about things, we have our own unique thoughts. And voice is translating individuality onto the page. Doesn't mean you have to be clever, clever sentence structure or use a word for blue that no one's ever thought of before. It doesn't mean that. It just means there is an angle at which you look at the earth and at the world. It's just a slight tilt of the head and it's your tilt of the head. And that's what voice is. And like I say, the only thing that you've got apart from the greats that is different to the greats is the fact that you're you. No one else had your grandmother, your bedroom, that best friend, that boyfriend, that loss of a pet at the age of seven. No one had that experience. Only you had that experience. So you have to channel that individuality into the voice, into the words on the page, and stick to it. I can remember going to an event. It was the first big event I'd done for Penguin, and I was on stage as the big debut, if you like. In the green room, there was John le Carré, Gilly Cooper, Zadie Smith, and Jamie Oliver, and loads of other people. I was just like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And for various reasons, I wanted to ask Jamie Oliver to contribute something to my scholarship. So I just thought, I'm never going to be in a room with Jamie Oliver again, ever, ever, ever. So I just thought, take it, have the balls to go and talk to him. So
yeah,
asked him. He was absolutely lovely and gracious and generous and contributed. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I actually don't know. You know, I just don't know why I'm here in this company. And he said, well, you must have written something great. And we talked about that. And he said, I'm just going to give you one piece of advice. And he said, always be you. Now, that was always be you in the public domain. But what he really meant was, and the reason he's got somewhere is because when he hit the screen, there was nobody that said, take a handful of flour and a bit of this. And if you haven't got that, use this. He had that unique boyish enthusiasm and rough and ready around the outside. And he also had an Essex accent. What he was really saying to me is, don't lose your Brummie accent. Yeah. Whatever you're writing, carry on writing it. You have got a reason to be here and enjoy it. Every writer will tell you that there are some things that once you start writing, you know it's you. If there's an authenticity to the words and on the page, and you think, that's me, that sentence, the hard thing, of course, then, is making the next sentence you and the next sentence and the next sentence. But there are certain bits of any writing we've ever done, every writer that's listening goes, oh, I know it's that bit in my book. And you know you've hit it. You know there's me on the page.
I was really, really struck by something you said at the beginning, like your answer was, you know, I wasn't looking to write. Something I was really, really wanting to talk about with you was the kind of concept of time. I think one of the biggest barriers to starting writing is time. And a lot of the work you do with the Creative Writing Scholarship and your kind of backing of audiobooks, and I know that your memoir is going to be a bite-sized book, part of the quick reads thing. The kind of through line of all of those to me are that you're supporting people, giving them the time to actually go and study it. So I'm quite interested to talk about kind of how time factors in terms of changing the industry to make it more accessible for people.
Yeah, it's a really good question about time. And one of the interesting things about being a working class writer coming from my background is that so many writers come to writing when they have got more time, because maybe the actual critical things that you have to do as a young person, maybe you're raising a family, maybe you've got caring responsibilities, you know, you're pouring your time into other things. And sometimes, and not always, as you get older, things calm down, or you get this hour, or you get 2 hours, whatever, a day, a week, and you can start to write. Or sometimes, certainly as you get older, you think, hang on a minute, when am I going to do this thing? You watch your years go by doing the mundane or just the necessary, and you think, hang on, if I don't do this now, I am going to run out of time. I'm 63, by the way, and I consider myself mid-career. There's no beige polyester trousers and a blue rinse for me. I am not going gently. I would like to be writing until they remove the pen from my hand. Not that someone says, oh, actually, you're not relevant. You haven't got anything to say. That day will obviously come. The other thing about time is that, and time and space are very, very similar things. So people often quote to me, which makes me ill, Virginia Woolf said, you need to have a room of your own. Unless she's talking about spiritual and emotional space in your head, for many, many writers, they haven't even got a biro of your own. You're writing by hand in a ring binder that you got from Aldi. You haven't got a room of your own. It's dated. It's elitist. It's writing to, she was an upper class woman, writing to other upper class to middle class women. But similarly, many, many families share one laptop with six people. It's the laptop. It's not my laptop. So this idea of having emotional space and emotional time is just as important as having the physical space, obviously, and the physical time. Obviously, it's vital to carve something out. And just what you said about audiobooks, it's one way, like you can listen to a podcast, you know, you can listen to a podcast in 5 minute chunks and you're still going to get the podcast. A bit more difficult with books. You really want to have 20 minutes of your book at a time if you want to stick with it, but it's not impossible. If we love something, if we really, really love something, we will find the time for it. We all find the time to check Twitter or Instagram or whatever. That's 7 minutes. You know, in 7 minutes, you could very likely write a sentence. Or if you can't write a sentence, you could sit down in a, you know, if you're a cafe or at work and look at someone's shoes and just describe the shoes. Just describe the shoes. It might not ever end up in a book, but you're exercising that writing muscle. And similarly, if for 2 weeks you know you haven't got time to write and you've got this half a book, stay near your work. So, okay, I can't write, but what I could do is I could think about that character and think about, have they done this and have that? And that's something you can do when you're doing a boring job. You're mopping the floor. You're looking after the kids. You're making the dinner. And okay, I can't write. I just can't write. I haven't got the space or whatever. But I can stay emotionally close to my work. And that's another way of doubling down on time. I've got these horrible jobs to do or these necessary jobs to do, or I'm sitting next to somebody in hospital while they have chemo, and this is what I'm going to do. And for anyone that thinks to themselves, oh, I've missed the boat because I'm 60 and I haven't written my book yet, I'm 63. And my book was published when I was 56, and it could easily have been 58. So it's never too late if you have the desire.
The beginning of your memoir, there's this one line that just really struck me where you say, three times every week, I'm reminded the world will end and I will die. In an interview, I can't remember, it may have been with The Guardian, you spoke about when you left home at 16, you were quite relatively able to just discard it and leave. But also you say that these thoughts followed you into your 30s and that you found it really difficult to say anything anti-Jehovah. And I'm quite interested in this kind of internal conflict in terms of like religion for you and various other identities. What impact does that have on you, like going into your 30s and not quite being able to completely shed something that maybe you want to, but then also feeling this connection in terms of family and religion? And
yes, I mean, it's really about having this multifaceted experience. And if you're, you know, mixed race, everyone thinks, oh, you've just, you know, you've got two cultures. It's never two cultures. And if you're white, it's never two cultures. You know, in terms of the communities I belong to, I am African Caribbean, I am Irish, I am British, I am an adopted mother, I am a tennis fan, I am a Brummie completely, and even in Brummie circles, I'm a Moseley Brummie, I'm a writer, I'm part of that community, and every single person has got multiple ideas. You know, I support Manchester United, or I've got an allotment, or whatever it is. You know, everyone's part of different communities. When we become integrated, in other words, we don't feel that these communities pull apart, these communities don't fracture, but they blend into that unique person. And it's part of what I was saying earlier on, that all of those things is what makes us unique. And the challenge, and it is a challenge, especially if we're part of a community that people don't appreciate, like the Black community or class, working class community, the challenge for all of us is to become integrated and to say, I love this about me and I love that about me and that and this and that and that, and feeling no shame about who we are. My memoir clearly outlines how hungry I was, terrible clothes we had to wear, that we were cold, that I wasn't like my friends, couldn't go where my friends went. We didn't have the right furniture. Sometimes we didn't have any furniture. We certainly didn't have any carpet. My friends were going to the school disco. I only had my school uniform. That's my outfit. Everything else is a rag. And it's about saying, yes, that's part of me. Would I want it to happen again? No. Was it right to feel ashamed? Don't know. It was understandable to feel ashamed, if not right. And just celebrating and accepting all of those parts, and then using all of those parts in your writing. So, for example, I know the shame of not having the right clothes, but let's just say I don't know the shame about getting teased for having ginger hair when you're a child. I don't know what that's like. But using the shame I do know about, I can empathize and I can use that experience of the internal pain to say, well, I don't know that, but I do know that. That enables us to write about experiences that we have not had. So you might not, let's say you want to write a book about someone being in the wilderness. Lots of us haven't been in the wilderness for 3 years, but maybe we've emotionally been in the wilderness for 3 years. Maybe we've been separated from someone from 3 years. So we can use that experience from our childhood or from our background and then translate it into another kind of experience so that we've got something to pull on that brings our writing alive. Otherwise, we would all be writing pretty boring stories about our own experiences. If I wrote my own experiences, I'd be woman goes to Tesco. That's basically my life these days. But I don't want to write that. I want to write more interesting things, but I can use some of my pain and trauma of your childhood, using that trauma and how that feels, and how that feels in the gut and how it feels in the head, and get to write about experiences beyond our own.
When you have both internalized oppression and structures working against you, essentially, how much harder is it to make choices to do the things we want to do creatively? And how can we turn the world upside down and change the structure specifically to the publishing industry? Because, you know, sometimes you can't just free yourself from the structures that work against you.
No, absolutely. You know, it's ridiculous to think that any of us on our own are ever going to change any structures. We're just not. We have to work within a system that has been going since books started being published. When books started being published, they were published for people who could read. That meant people that went to school. That meant they had some money. But books were never written for working class people. Universal education, that means that everybody goes to school and has the right to an education, has only been around since 19-something, you know, just over 100 years. Since regular everyday people had the right to an education, the right to learn. That system will not be dismantled by a couple of books saying working class writers are okay, thanks. It's just not going to happen. And the publishing industry is making masses attempts, and I'm going to put it at that, to change things slowly, but they are still changing them from within a system that is not equitable. It's not fair. It's in London. I'll say that again. It's in London. It's in London. It's in London, which means we have to go there. Of course, there's loads of, you know, little office in Manchester, office in Liverpool. Let me tell you, it happens in London, and that's all there is to it. I don't personally think that will ever change, that the headquarters will be in London. And so we have to work within it. Thank God for Zoom. And it's probably the only good thing that came out of the pandemic was Zoom. So that a lot of these things can happen now without us paying 160 quid and spending 3 hours to get to London. We have to still make an effort to help one another, I think. I think we absolutely owe it to one another, if we have the ability to help other people succeed. Now, when I say that, I don't mean everyone has to do it, because you know what? Sometimes it's just enough to do it for yourself. And you shouldn't feel beaten up that you, I didn't contribute £5 to that magazine. I couldn't get to that event. I can't go to a writer's group because I'm looking after 6 children and my mom. Not everybody can do it, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up if we can't do it. Just doing the minor things, keeping ourselves together. Sometimes having a shower is like an accomplishment. And if that's what you're doing, that's fine. But if you can do something else, if you have the ability, the time or the connections or spare a couple of quid, then that's great. If you can't, your presence within the industry is a challenge to the industry if you're from a marginalized background. Just the fact that you are saying, here I am, just the fact that you are writing your story, just the fact that you say, I'm going to have a go, is in itself a challenge to the status quo. Your existence is the resistance to the system.
Based off of what you just said about do what you can, in a hypothetical, idealistic world, if you could make any changes, you know, however unrealistic they are, what is one or two things that you would do that you think could truly make a difference in the industry today?
It's not a case of who writes, because the writing is for everybody, and everybody can write. You can write on your phone, you can write entire stories on your phone. So it's not about who is writing, it's who the gatekeepers are. I would change the way books are promoted because, as we all know, and let's be clear, publishing is a commercial business. It might be an artistic business, but it has to turn a dollar. It has to make a profit. Mm. So the books that get the PR, the books that get the presence, have usually got a whole machine behind them. And I know, because I benefited from the machine. When Leon came out, I could not have had more help, better PR, more support from Penguin. It was utterly brilliant. And of course, I think Leon's a good book, but I saw how it was made to connect with people. It was helped to connect with people. It would be great if we could see some minor books that haven't got great big advances behind them have that kind of attention. It is a case of there being more and better representation of gatekeepers, more and better representation at board level of people from different backgrounds, and more imaginative ways of connecting with readers. So fortunately, graphic novels have now stopped being the core relation of the publishing world, because graphic novels are what lots and lots of young kids connect with. They're not going to pick up Treasure Island anytime soon, but they might look at a graphic novel where, you know, some of their, you know, heroes started, Avengers, Spider-Man, that they're comics and graphic novels. And I think looking at broader ways to connect with readers where readers are. So that's why I'm all in favour of audiobooks. For some people, the sight of a book would bring them out in hives does not mean they don't like stories, because they'll watch films, all right. They'll watch a 20-part series, which is a book, as we know, that's a 20-chapter book or a 40-chapter book. Mm-hmm. So it's not that people don't like stories. Sometimes they don't like reading, and they don't like, you know, for some people they left school at 15. Some people haven't had a great education. Some people only read the sports pages in the Sun. Taking away less stigma from different forms of engaging with stories, that whether that is audiobooks, whether that's podcasts about books rather than the book itself, maybe people just want to hear about it, interviews, graphic novels, maybe some hybrid ways of telling stories that's a bit graphic novel, a bit audio, or a bit film. I think those things will emerge. I'm somebody that loves the classics, and I love big, thick books, and I like long words. So I'm well catered for in the publishing industry. I can go and find 1,000 books in Waterstones tomorrow that I would like to read quite easily. I read fiction, non-fiction, memoir, biography, travel, cookery. I read them all. So I'm a great reader. That's not everybody. And the industry caters for me over and over and over again. My son, who's got dyslexia, who has never voluntarily read a book in his life, don't expect he ever will, he would probably read something that catered to him, maybe a graphic novel or whatever. So just being a bit more exciting and new and forward-thinking and less snobby about what is reading.
Yeah.
And what's a good book in inverted commas. Less snobbery about people that read Mills and Boone. Less snobbery around people that say, oh, I only read Jack Reacher. Well, that's great. Read Jack Reacher. Take the only out of that sentence. I don't only read Mills and Boone and Jack Reacher. I read Mills and Boone and Jack Reacher. Love it. Thank you very much. That all of us stop apologising for our reading tastes unless we read, you know, War and Peace or in the original. Do you know what I mean? It's nonsense.
One of the things that you've said at the beginning of your career when you started writing, that you dissected loads of books, and you said that you looked at what made an ending work and what didn't. And I'm wondering if you have any examples of endings that work and that don't.
Yes. Straight away, I can think of one of the best endings I've ever read, where I read this book and I probably got 7 pages from the end. So I knew it was ending. And I got there and I slammed it shut and I went, no, 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 no. And I don't cry, but I'm not a crier. And I was nearly in tears. And I thought, oh, no. And I didn't want it to be confirmed. It was so good. Oh, my God, it was so well done. And I'll tell you the book in a minute, but the reason it was so well done, you didn't even know you were being drawn here. You were being drawn here from the very, very beginning of the book. You were being taken to this particular place, this particular time, this particular attitude, and it's so downbeat. There is nothing dramatic about this moment, nothing. But the work of the author, it's literally like someone making you a banquet and they put the last thing on the table and you go, oh, my God, yes. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, oh, my God. Anyway, it's The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone's read the book, but it doesn't matter if you read the book or not, because the reason the book's called The Remains of the Day is because there's a scene earlier on in the book where this man who has missed his chance with this woman. She's been there and she's been sort of saying, notice me, notice me, notice me. And he can't notice her. He's, I can't see you, I can't see you. 20 years on, maybe even 25 years on, he thinks, oh, what about that woman? So he meets her and he's about to sort of make her this proposition, which was not by any means marriage. And she says, my daughter's having a baby, it's great. So she more or less says to him, I'm doing something else with my life, thank you very much. And in one scene, they go along a pier. And as they get to the end of the pier, all the lights come on. And when the lights come on, everyone claps. And so he says, why do people clap? for the lights coming on at the end of the day. And she says, because you've only got, it's a celebration of the remains of the day. All you've got left now is a few hours with the lights on. That's the last bit of the day. And it's, you don't even know that's a big point at that time. He goes back there when he gets the rebuff, and the rebuff is not the rebuff of him as a man. It's a realization he has that what the fuck was I thinking to turn her down all those years ago? It's like a sucker punch where he goes, okay, I messed up big time. All I have left now is the remains of my day. Oh my God, it was so good. It was so good, so very, very good. It was written with the most restraint. There is not one incident in that book that you would say, oh, drama, or there's no murder, there's no, do you know what I mean? There's no big events. There are tiny events. When you taken as a whole, you are wrung out at the end. You're just like, oh, my goodness. And I can remember after reading the book, I saw that Merchant Ivory were making it into a film, and I just said, I will never watch it. Never. Because the book's perfect.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be ruined. And when I watched the film, it was excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent. I think that's one of the best endings I've ever read.
Sounds great. Even hearing you just relay the story was so poignant.
If you teach, if anybody teaches, or if anyone wants an example, it's an example of two very good things, three things I would say. The book, if you want to read it as a teaching aid for yourself, it's perfect. Unreliable narrator, the best unreliable narrator apart from Zoe Heller, Notes on a Scandal. Unreliable narrator, got it down. Second thing that it's good for, very, very good for, is two timelines. And the third thing that it's very good for is restraint. What you get from this book is, I'm not going to tell you this, 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 and this. I'm going to give you three quarters, and you're going to work out the last quarter of this sentence, the last quarter of what I mean, the last quarter of the story. So it's a book in show, don't tell. It's a book, a great example of the reader withholding just that bit that gives you space to enter into the book.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Okay. I do have another question on, but I'm now going to have to limit you by saying you can't answer with the remains of the day.
Right. Yes.
But it's, so if you could pass a law that everyone in the world had to read one book, what book would you make mandatory and why?
Probably, so I've got a bookcase of books that I use when I'm teaching. The book is The Thing About December by Donal Ryan. Utterly, utterly, utterly brilliant. It's about a young man. I think he's maybe 20, maybe a bit younger, or maybe a bit older. Anyway, he's the young man of older parents, and the parents die, and he owns a farm. It is magnificent. It's as simple a book as you could ever read. Simple, simple language. The boy's, he's not bright. He hasn't got learning difficulties, but he's not a bright boy. He's a very simple farmer's son. And it's about what happens to him. The audiobook is a thing of beauty because Donal Ryan reads it the way it should be read. He's got an Irish accent, obviously. This all happens in Ireland. It's utterly heartbreaking and extremely clever in its simplicity. And as we all know, it's very hard to do something simple. The simpler something is, the more you can spot mistakes. And this is brilliant in its simplicity. But having said that, most Donal Ryan books are just exquisite.
I do have a question about specifically your writing process now.
Yes.
And it's about your late night endeavours of writing 9 p.m. on to 3 or 4 a.m. You said that you've sometimes written your best work during that window. And I think for me, so I'm the same. I'm quite productive at night, I think just naturally I kind of wake up a bit later in the day, but also the kind of history of that for me is also that it's been the only time that I've been able to factor it into my day by extending the day. You only have the remains of your day left when you're working in somewhere like retail and you get home at 11 p.m. you've got to extend that day or you're not going to do what you want to do. How do we go about buying time for people that need their voices heard?
First of all, again, comparison is the thief of joy. Don't compare yourself with someone else. You know, I can't tell you the amount of blogs I see where they say, oh, I do 1,000 words a day. Oh, I wake up at 6 and I do 500 words. Great if you do. Great if you do. I write when I've got something to say. If I've got nothing to say, I don't write. I just don't do it. Because I've made that mistake where I forced myself to do this mythical. When I first started writing, there is not a blog written by a writer I like that I didn't read. Sadie Smith does 1,000 words a day, but on a Saturday she does 500. So that's what I did. Oh, right. Okay. Sebastian Barry writes 5,000 words at the weekend, but nothing. Okay. That's what I'll do. I'm looking for the recipe. I'm looking for the equation that goes 2 + 2 - 7 equals success. There is no equation that equals success. So you write when you've got the time to write and the headspace to write. And if you can't write 500 words, as I said earlier on, stay near the work in your head and in your heart. And don't be thinking, unless I've written 500 words, I'm a failure because X can write 5,000 words. If you write one good sentence a week, then that's what you've written. Better to write one good sentence a week than 4,000 words that end up in the bin. Write your one sentence and say, that's a good sentence. I'm happy with that. Rather than forcing yourself to just put words down on the page for the sake of it so that you can say, oh, I wrote 500 words today. Well, I can't do that. I just can't. I write when I've got, you know, the space, the time, and I do feel I've got something to say.
Thank you to Kit DeWall for being the subject of this month's interview. We'll post links in our show notes so you can find out more about Kit and her work. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write On Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for Pen to Print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.